This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My fellow citizens, today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal. This ceremony is held in the depth of winter, but by the words we speak and the faces we show the world, we force the spring.
With those words, Bill Clinton began his first speech as the 42nd President of the United States. We watched, we listened, looking for insights into our new president and the directions he will lead us in. Harry Shearer watched, looking for clues about the man he will be satirizing for the next 4 years. Shearer's political satire is heard regularly on All Things Considered and his own national radio program, Le Show. He's also a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and does many of the voices on The Simpsons. We called Harry Shearer to find out what he thought of President Clinton's inaugural address.
Well, first of all, I'd say that as the first member of the baby boom generation to take this high office, I was a little surprised at Bill Clinton allowing the Marine Band to play the Monty Python theme.
Yes.
Before the oath.
That's right.
I thought that was sort of a slipped stitch there because. While George Bush could have been excused for not knowing the association, there's no excuse for Bill Clinton not getting it.
That's right. I forget the name of what the march is actually called.
But we all know it as the Monty Python thing.
Exactly.
And I was sitting here with a friend, and we were both saying that this sets up a very dangerous expectation of a giant gorilla's foot coming down on the whole ceremony.
Good point. What about the writing of the speech?
Well, you know, I think that the speech was written with a very functional attitude. That is to say, Bill Clinton, we know, is capable of writing and enjoying giving a very long speech. So I think left to his own devices, he might have done that, except it seemed to me like the speech was written so it would be short enough that he couldn't lose his voice during the speech itself. It seemed when he rose to those certain high moments that he was really like checking to make sure the voice was going to be there when he reached the high point of it. The actual writing, you know, I think this will go down as a serviceable one. Basically, its insistence on a meteorological oddity, forcing the spring, is about the only thing that you sort of remember from it.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Do you think that works?
Well, it had a certain meaningfulness, and yet, you know, all I saw really was sort of cold fronts going across the upper Midwest when he said it, so...
Any other lines that will stand out in your mind, you know, that you will remember?
Well, if I will, I'm not remembering them now. So they'll have to be brought back by repeated viewings on videotape later.
What was going through your mind when you were watching the now First Family during the inauguration? Were you reading any thoughts into their heads?
Well, you know, it's I was watching this avowed Elvis fan watching Marilyn Horne doing a hyper distinguished performance, thinking, and I'm wondering if he's sort of measuring himself against the cultural élan of the Kennedys at these moments, and going, well, this is what Kennedy would have listened to. This is what Jackie would have made Jack do at the inauguration. So I'll have some of this.
Did you start wondering who chose Marilyn Horne?
Well, he did.
He did? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Were you wondering what Bush was thinking as he was leaving Washington?
Well, you know, I heard him listening to the speech and you ungrateful little draft dodger, that kind of, as he was, you know, as he kept hearing references to drift. Hey, drift this. That was all I could think that he was thinking. And I thought there was a wonderful euphemism that somebody used on television to describe the burden being lifted from Barbara Bush's shoulders, that she was going to have a lot more of George to herself. Because, of course, there have been all these rumors about the affair with at least one major Washington figure in the State Department. And I thought, well, that's the most elegant possible way of putting an end to that. By getting your husband diselected.
Do you have memories of other inaugurals? Have you been watching them over the years?
The one I have most clear memory of is the 1980 inaugural, partly because it was that weird release of the hostages going on at the exact same moment, and you know, that started people wondering for years and years and years until the House, of course, removed all doubt earlier in October. And the other reason I remembered is because I had an adult case of the chicken pox and was trying to find a comfortable position to place my head in to watch Reagan swear in.
It must have been horrible.
Yes, it was, but, you know, I got over it, and so did the country.
Have you been trying to get down Clinton's voice?
Yes. Yeah, I've done him a few times, and obviously now the, you know, they talk about the pressure on him, but really, Terry.
The pressure's on you, I know.
Much more on me, because all he has to do is be himself.
Whereas you have to be him.
Well, I have to be him. He's not trying to be me.
Gee, you know.
Yeah.
What a valuable perception.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, so what are you going to do to try to be him?
Well, I try like going out in very cold and windy weather and just yelling at the top of my lungs to get that sandpaper quality. You know, that thing right there, that thing that's we're going to get very used to very soon.
Well, Harry, I look forward to hearing more of your political satire, and thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thanks, Terry. My pleasure.
Harry Shearer's political satire can be heard on All Things Considered and his own program, Le Show, which is carried on many public radio stations around the country. Fresh Air linguist Jeff Nunberg listened to the inaugural address. He's the usage editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. We asked him to share his impressions of the president's speech.
Well, I had the impression of somebody writing an abstract of an inaugural address. Maybe that's why it was so short. I mean, he sits there with all the text of all the previous inaugural addresses and kind of writes an abstract with summaries and allusions to the things that other inaugurals have said. So there's a little Kennedy, a little Roosevelt, a little King, and then he's out.
What are some of the images that struck you as summaries of standard themes?
Well, there was a little bit. There was, of course, this renewal business, which is a standard theme, and then there was a little bit of Roosevelt. But where Roosevelt had said, "How did it go? I see one third of a country ill housed, ill fed, ill clothed." Clinton had, when most people are working harder for less, when others cannot work at all, or when the cost of health care threatens our families and threatens to bankrupt our enterprises, great and small. There was a little Kennedy, I challenge a new generation of Americans to a season of service, offer more opportunity to all, and demand more responsibility from all, with a pretty clear allusion to ask not what you can do for your country. But all put in a more prosy way, which maybe wasn't bad. Maybe that's the way an inaugural address should be nowadays. Maybe Clinton's finally got television.
Well, in the sense of like being more casual,
less formal, briefer at last.
Yeah, I think the departure from that informality was that last image about. From this joyful mountaintop of celebration, we hear a call to service in the valley. We have heard the trumpets.
Right. There was a lot of King in that. And in fact, the way he said that, from this joyful mountaintop of celebration, he stressed joyful in a way that really recalled King's voice, not just King's words. And that was the allusion to King, yeah, absolutely.
Is there any part of the speech that struck you as particularly informal for a presidential inauguration address?
Well, there was one point at which he was talking about politics, and he was talking about the Capitol. He said, powerful people worry endlessly about who is in and who is out, who is up and who is down. It was probably the most strikingly informal line that's ever appeared in an inaugural address.
Do you think that's a good thing or an okay thing?
Well, I don't know if he intended it to be so informal, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, he really wasn't speaking to, for all his invocations of posterity, I had a sense he really wasn't speaking to posterity, but speaking to... present-day Americans. Even the attempts to produce memorable history-making lines were kind of summary and not particularly strong. So there were about 3 points at which I saw him going for the memorable quote for the history books. This is our time. Let us embrace it. And there's nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America, and we must do what America does best, offer more opportunity to all and demand more responsibility from all. But in all case, in all those three cases, they were kind of summary efforts almost at producing a memorable quote. There wasn't really any attempt at that ringing eloquence that what we used to expect from an inaugural address.
What did you think of Maya Angelou's poem?
I thought she was trying to do everything that Clinton wasn't, trying to speak to history and so on. I mean, there were a couple of things that were striking. One is that in the entire poem, she never used the word America. There was just this long list of the Hispanic, the Asian, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Rabbi, the gay, the straight, the privileged, and so on. You had the sense that she was aiming for at creating the poem that would be the obligatory epigraph in every multicultural Basil reading series from now on.
Did you get the feeling that that list was supposed to end with, and the white guy?
And the white guy, yeah.
So the poem didn't work for you?
No, the poem didn't work for me. There was one point when she said that she talked about something about the mastodon and the dinosaur who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. And my mind was racing, but I don't think she had in mind what I did.
What did you have in mind?
I'm sure she just meant the bones. Not the mastodon droppings on the rock and the river and the tree. I don't know where.
How important do you think inaugural speeches are? What do they mean to people?
I don't know. You know, the way the press talks about them, it's always as well, this is your one shot to get a line in the history books. But I don't know if students have to memorize inaugural addresses anymore in school. So I'm not sure. It is this one occasion for a conspicuously formal address to the American people, and this one occasion in which presidents measure themselves against posterity as orators. I think people have a sense of that, although I'm not sure that it really has much of an effect on the way people actually go on to perceive the administration.
Did the young Jeff Nunberg have to memorize presidential inaugural speeches?
Oh, yeah, with malice, with charity toward none, with malice toward none, with charity toward whatever, however. Yeah, I had to memorize Lincoln's second inaugural, and of course, Kennedy's inaugural, I imagine students a little younger than me had to memorize. So, sure, along with Patrick Henry and all of that stuff.
Well, I'll let you get back until you get that whole speech right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for talking with us.
Bye-bye, Terry.
Jeff Nunberg is Fresh Air's linguist. He's associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Coming up, what faces our new president in Iraq? This is Fresh Air. One of President Bush's last acts in office was to bomb Iraq, to forcefully make the point that Iraq must comply with UN resolutions. Iraq has declared a ceasefire in what it described as a goodwill gesture to President Clinton. For some insights into what awaits President Clinton, we call Jeffrey Kemp of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The Control of the Middle East Arms Race. He served in the Reagan administration as the National Security Council's Director for the Near East and South Asia. I asked him what he thought motivated Saddam Hussein to declare a ceasefire.
I think he wants to send a signal to the Arab world, to the UN, to the Europeans, to Bill Clinton, that really his quarrel was with George Bush, not with the United States and the rest of the world, that George Bush is gone. Therefore, let's have a clean start and see whether we can work out some deal. I think that's his wish. I think it is, quite bluntly, wishful thinking to think Clinton will buy onto it.
In the recent interview that Clinton gave with the New York Times, he said he wasn't obsessed with Saddam Hussein and that he would judge Saddam Hussein on his behavior. It's been pointed out that Saddam Hussein's, quote, good behavior can be just another tactic to get us, to get the United States to behave the way that Saddam Hussein wants us to. How would you recommend that Clinton judge Saddam Hussein's behavior?
Well, my bet is that once Clinton starts the daily, in fact, sometimes three or four times a day, briefings on foreign policy, which he'll be getting as of tomorrow, my guess is he soon, too, will become obsessed with this man, because so long as Saddam Hussein is in power, it's very difficult to orchestrate a coherent and meaningful American strategy for the Middle East. In particular, it's difficult to see how we can come to grips with perhaps a more serious, longer-term challenge, which is the growth of Iran and the possibility that Iran will be formulating and fermenting unrest throughout the Middle East in the months and years to come. So while I think Clinton initially wanted to draw a distinction between Bush's behavior towards Saddam and how he would respond. Increasingly, I think he's going to have to adopt much the same policies. And if Saddam lives up to his usual billing, he too will get under Bill Clinton's craw, and Clinton will have to deal with him in much the same sort of way.
So you think there's going to be a period in which Clinton tests Saddam Hussein and Saddam Hussein tests President Clinton?
Yes, in a sense, because I doubt very much whether Clinton is anxious to unleash the United States Air Force and Navy tomorrow, particularly since the strikes that Bush conducted last week have been getting some flack from countries such as Russia and France, key allies who are necessary to hold this coalition together. On the other hand, I don't think Clinton can wait indefinitely, because while Saddam may say he's offering an olive branch, and while the headlines may not report violations of UN Security Council resolutions, it has to be remembered that one of the most sinister things that is going on in Iraq right now is Saddam Hussein's systematic undermining of the security and welfare of the Kurdish population in the north, which we are vowed to protect. Saddam has been interfering with UN relief operations, has been sabotaging those operations. There have been incidences of terrorism perpetrated by Saddam's personnel against the Kurds. This will continue. It will continue as the winter gets harsher and harsher, and Clinton will get daily briefings on this. So at some point, you know, I would suggest in weeks rather than months, Clinton's going to have to make some tough statement on Iraq. Hopefully he will do so after he's lined up some international support, got to know some of the foreign leaders that he's going to have to deal with. Like it or not, that day is coming.
There has been the question, and even some of our allies have raised the question, of whether the force that we use was proportionate to Iraq's transgressions. How do you measure that?
You can't, quite frankly. My feeling is that Iraq's transgressions are so enormous, particularly if you take into account everything that has been disclosed since the end of the war concerning the atrocities against the Kurds, that short of literally occupying or using Iraq or using weapons of mass destruction, there's virtually nothing we could do that would be proportionate to the tragedies that Saddam Hussein has inflicted on his people and the neighborhood. That said, I do think there is a very serious problem in the context of proportionality and even-handedness when it comes to comparing our actions in the Middle East as distinct from our non-actions in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And here, I think, quite frankly, the Arabs, indeed the Muslim world, has a point when they say you do nothing to enforce the UN no-fly zones in former Yugoslavia, but you bomb Saddam at a whim. But I think you'll find that most countries in the Middle East, while disturbed about the recent use of force against Iraq, privately, if you ask the leaders of the Arab world in private, wish Saddam Hussein were killed. They wish they would love to see him overthrown. What they do not want to see left behind is chaos in Iraq. They would like to see a regime other than Saddam Hussein's in control, a regime we could work with, a regime that in the last resort could become a check to the growing power of Iran, which I alluded to earlier.
But that regime would have to be run by someone other than Saddam Hussein?
That is correct, yes.
Are there contenders in Iraq for that position?
Well, there are obviously generals and colonels lurking around Saddam's corridors who clearly would take over if Saddam were assassinated. Whether they would be any better for us or not is a matter of dispute. I somewhat doubt it. The Iraqi exiles, the types who we would probably like to see take power, are located, you know, in the north, in the Kurdish area, in London, all over the place. And unfortunately, they don't present as united and coordinated a front as we would like, and therefore it's difficult to single out individuals who one could designate as successors to Saddam Hussein. One option Clinton has, incidentally, is to make much more of an Iraqi government in exile and to work within the framework of the United Nations to formally de-recognize Saddam as the leader of Iraq. This would be difficult. It'll take a lot of agility and persuasion on the part of the new UN ambassador, Madeleine Albright, but it's certainly a new tactic that Clinton might want to follow.
Would you recommend to Clinton covert action in Iraq, covert assassination of Saddam Hussein, covert attempts to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Well, of course, there are laws about this, and the first thing that would have to happen is we'd have to change the law that forbids assassination. If the law were changed, certainly it is one thing, one option to think of. But short of that, there's dozens of things we can do. We can infiltrate, we can stir up trouble in the north and the south, we can help mess up his economy through sabotage and the planting of phony counterfeit money in Iraq. If we put the assets into this, there's a lot more we could do. And now that the Soviet Union no longer exists, and we have this vast intelligence service that still sits out there, you know, in Langley, Virginia, I mean, it may well be that Clinton wants to, you know, use Mr. Woolsey and his assets to work on the Saddam problem as much as he wants to use General Powell and the United States military establishment.
From what you know of President Clinton's choices for Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, what directions do you think they will be taking American foreign policy in the Middle East in?
I think it will be, particularly in the case of the Middle East, almost identical to Bush. If anything, I could see them being a little tougher. I think in Aspin, in Woolsey, in Tony Lake, who will be the National Security Advisor, and in some of the people in the State Department, including, I think, at this point, Warren Christopher, there is no appetite whatsoever for appeasing Saddam Hussein, making any concessions to Saddam Hussein. If anything, this group are going to be more pro-Israeli than the Bush administration. In short, I would say that if Saddam Hussein thinks he's going to have a honeymoon, it will be a very short-lived one.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Jeffrey Kemp is a senior associate with the Carnegie Institute for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Our interview is recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.